content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman of North Carolina Reading Service. And we are reading Time Magazine today, and the issue is dated January 20th, 2020. The magazine is beginning with the For the Record section, and we go there now, the one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing, a headline or caption in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Beatrice Tosti di Valminuta, co-owner of a bar and restaurant in New York City, in a January 6th New York Times story about the Trump administration's suggestion that it may impose 100% tariffs on European wine. And the quotation from Beatrice Tosti di Valminuta, quote, "This will be the end of us," unquote. In the lower right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 6.4 million. Caption explains, low-end estimate of Americans who've caught the flu in what's on track to be one of the worst seasons for the virus in years, per CDC data released January 3rd. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, fake beef. Burger King unveils a plant-based patty in the UK, but says it's cooked on the same grills as beef. Under Good Week, fake pork. Impossible Foods introduces a new pork substitute at CES in Las Vegas. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $3.2 million. Caption explains, approximate total spent on legal recreational marijuana in Illinois on January 1st, the first day of sales in the state, $3.2 million. In the lower left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Leila Moran, British lawmaker, in an interview with Pink News after coming out as pansexual in a January 2nd tweet. The quotation from British lawmaker Leila Moran, quote, "It doesn't matter about the physical attributions of the person you fall in love with," unquote. Caption goes on to say, she is thought to be the first out pansexual lawmaker in the UK. Still in the left margin of the page, but higher up, this story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $495,000. Caption explains, asking price for each of two decommissioned nuclear missile silos on the market in Arizona, $495,000 each. At the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Lizzo, singer and Times 2019 Entertainer of the Year, in a January 5th message declaring she was taking a break from Twitter. And the quotation from Lizzo in all caps, quote, "too many trolls," unquote. In the upper middle of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Alex Trebek, Jeopardy host, asked if he had a message for Representative John Lewis in an Associated Press interview published January 6th. The Georgia Democrat revealed his diagnosis in December, and Trebek made his own cancer fight public in March 2019. The quotation from Alex Trebek, quote, "We're starting a new year, and let's see if we can't both complete the year as pancreatic cancer survivors," unquote. In the lower center of the page is the story illustrated by a quotation from the U.S. Selective Service System. After its website crashed January 3rd amid fears of war with Iran, and the quotation from the U.S. Selective Service System, quote, "Due to the spread of misinformation, our website is experiencing high traffic volumes at this time," unquote. And that's the entire content of the For the Record page in the front of the magazine. Leading off the magazine, main body is the big section, The Brief, and the subsection that opens it is called Opener. And within the opener, the bulletin, where the headline is, "Attack at Top Delhi University Signals Rising Tensions in India." Article by Billy Perigo and Samir Yasir. They write, "With a bandaged hand and bruises on his back, student Santosh Singh says he no longer feels safe at Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University, parenthetically JNU, one of India's top schools. On January 5th, he and some 30 others were injured when masked men stormed the campus, armed with rods, bats, and stones to attack students who were protesting a fee increase." Quote, "I thought they were going to kill us," unquote, Singh tells Time. And then Billy Perigo and Samir Yasir name three examples or incidents. The first, mob rules. To Singh, it seems clear who the masked men were. Quote, "They were ABVP goons," unquote, he says, referring to members of a right-wing Hindu nationalist student organization affiliated with the BJP, the party of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Quote, "Their slogans, their style of talking, and the word they love most, traitors, was on their lips when they were beating us," unquote. The ABVP denies involvement, but reports suggest the attack was coordinated on ABVP WhatsApp groups, and experts say it fits a pattern of intimidation by Modi's government and its allies against universities. Second part, desperate times. Those universities, longtime bastions of progressive thought, now feel increasingly out of step with the country's prevailing political climate. Since his re-election last May, Modi has rewarded his base by delivering on several long-held Hindu nationalist goals, including a controversial new law that would offer a pathway to citizenship for asylum seekers from three neighboring countries, provided they are not Muslims, India's largest minority and a regular BJP target. Final item, desperate measures. That law sparked a nationwide wave of protests from opponents of the BJP, including many university students and faculty, who said it was a flagrant violation of India's secular constitution, even though the students at JNU weren't protesting that law on January 5th. Many saw the attack as an attempt by Modi's supporters to intimidate intellectuals and demonstrators at a time when the government is struggling to keep them off the streets. entire article by Billy Perigo and Samir Yassir. In the right margin of this page is the regular feature News Ticker, consisting of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, earthquake rattles Puerto Rico. A 6.4 magnitude earthquake rocked Puerto Rico after it hit offshore in the pre-dawn hours of January 7th. It was the largest in a series of quakes that struck the island in the first week of the year. At least one person died, and eight were injured in the city of Ponce, and more than two-thirds of the island lost electricity. Second item in the middle. Methodist Church proposes split. The United Methodist Church may split over differences in belief on LGBTQ clergy and marriage equality, according to a proposal announced on January 3rd. Currently, quote, practicing, unquote, members of the LGBTQ community cannot become pastors, and pastors are barred from performing same-sex marriages. A vote on the proposals is scheduled for May. Final item on the bottom. China fights mysterious illness. Health officials in China struggled to identify a mysterious pneumonia-like virus contracted by 59 people in the city of Wuhan. Authorities said on January 5th they had ruled out SARS, that's S-A-R-S, all caps, which killed more than 800 people during an epidemic that started in China in 2002. Moving forward, we are now at the milestones page with the lead item under started. The trial of Harvey Weinstein, a watershed moment for Me Too. Observance written by Melissa Chan. Harvey Weinstein arrived hunched over a walker for the January 6th start of his New York City sexual assault trial. On the same day, prosecutors in Los Angeles filed separate rape and sexual assault charges against the once mighty movie mogul. The trial in New York is expected to take roughly 2 months, but merely by beginning, it marked a major moment for the Me Too movement, 2 years after a New York Times expose detailed three decades of sexual misconduct allegations against Weinstein, or Weinstein, and prompted dozens of other women in Hollywood to come forward with further accusations. In the New York trial, Weinstein, 67, is accused of raping an unidentified woman in a hotel room in 2013 and sexually assaulting a former production assistant in his apartment in 2006. He has pleaded not guilty to the charges and has denied all allegations of non-consensual sex. He could face life in prison if convicted. Regardless of the verdict, advocates for sexual assault survivors say it's a triumph to see Weinstein face a jury, even as they stress that the movement is bigger than his case. The wave of allegations against him helped to make Me Too go viral in 2017 and resulted in a cultural reckoning. At least 15 states have since passed new protections to better address sexual harassment and assault, according to the National Women's Law Center. Quote, although he may have been the spark that lit the flame here, unquote, says Tina Chin, president and CEO of the advocacy group Time's Up, quote, this is a flame that has extended far beyond, unquote. Observance written by Melissa Chan. This item is accompanied by a full-color candid photograph. Caption says, Weinstein leaves court on January 6th after the first day of his New York City trial for rape and sexual assault. He faces life in prison if convicted. And in the picture, in the center of the shot is Harvey Weinstein with a walker and wearing a suit. And he is accompanied by a police officer in uniform and a group of about four men in business suits who are surrounding and accompanying Harvey Weinstein. Still in milestones, under died Elizabeth Wurtzel, a voice of Gen X. Observance by Annabelle Guterman, who writes, when Elizabeth Wurtzel published her 1994 memoir, Prozac Nation, Young and Depressed in America, she was 27 years old. The book, an unflinching look at depression that detailed her relationship with the disease, solidified Wurtzel as a voice of Generation X. As she started conversations on serious topics by opening up about her own experiences, she also helped reshape and revive the modern American memoir. The signature candor that began with her discussions of clinical depression continued after she announced in 2015 that she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer. After her diagnosis, she began advocating for testing for the BRCA gene mutation, writing in the New York Times that she believed earlier testing could have prevented her from having cancer, which ultimately led to her death on January 7th at 52. In her books and her journalism, Wurtzel crafted intimate depictions of suffering and how to survive it. Quote, I don't think about the past or the future. I don't even worry about the present, unquote, she wrote for Time in 2018. Quote, I just do the next right thing, unquote. Observance by Annabelle Guterman. This item is accompanied by a full-color photograph of Elizabeth Wurtzel. The book mentioned in this item is Prozac Nation, Young and Depressed in America. Elizabeth Wurtzel, Wurtzel spelled Wurtzel. Prozac Nation, Young and Depressed in America, 1994. In the left margin of the page, under died conceptual artist John Baldessari on January 2nd, died at 88. Under one, that's spelled W-O-N, a vote in Parliament on January 7th by Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, which will allow him to form a leftist coalition government. Under announced on January 8th that Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, intend to step back from duties as, quote, senior, unquote, royals, and split their time between the UK and North America. Under decided by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo not to run for a U.S. Senate seat in Kansas in 2020. Pompeo reportedly told Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of his decision on January 6th. Under sentenced, a British teenager in Cyprus to a four-month suspended jail term on January 7th after she was convicted of falsely accusing 12 Israeli men of rape. Her lawyers say she was forced to retract her accusation under police pressure. Under reported, that the U.S. cancer mortality rate dropped by 2.2% from 2016 to 2017, reported by the American Cancer Society on January 8th, representing the largest single-year decrease ever. 2.2%. Under banned, and that's spelled B-A-N-N-E-D, deep fake videos made using artificial intelligence and difficult to distinguish from authentic recordings, banned from Facebook on January 6th. And that is the entire content of the Milestones page. Going forward, the section here is World, and the headline is On the Brink, How 40 Years of Enmity Between Iran and the U.S. Collided in an Assassination. Article written by Kareem Sajjadpour. Major General Qasem Soleimani was born in 1957 to a self-described peasant family in Kerman, the sun-baked province in southeastern Iran, named for its pistachios, rose water, and hospitable inhabitants. Family debts forced him to leave school and earn a living as a construction worker at age 13. By his late teens, Soleimani was swept up in the country's growing political fervor that culminated in one of the greatest geopolitical earthquakes of the past half century, the 1979 revolution that replaced a U.S.-allied monarchy led by Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi with a viscerally anti-American theocracy led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. 5 days after Soleimani's assassination on January 3rd by a drone's missile fired on the order of President Trump were among the most fraught in the four decades of enmity between the U.S. and Iran, and a bowel-shaking lesson in the speed with which full-blown war can appear all but inevitable, even when neither side actually wants one. Quote, the fact that we have this great military and equipment does not mean we have to use it. We do not want to use it, unquote, Trump said in a televised address that had the feel of stepping onto firm ground from a roller coaster. Sharing space with this article is a companion piece. Under Viewpoint, the headline is Trump's Bold, Justifiable Gamble, by David French. Time says French is a Time columnist. He writes, when President Donald Trump ordered the death of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, he played perhaps his strongest card in a weak strategic hand. He placed a bold bet that his strike would brush back the Iranian regime, place it on its heels, and deter future attacks. It's a bet that he might lose, parenthetically, with terrible consequences. But it's far too soon to judge the outcome. For clarity, I'll repeat that sentence. It's a bet that he might lose, with terrible consequences, but it's far too soon to judge the outcome. I felt a sense of real relief when I heard of Soleimani's demise. I served in Iraq during the surge, and my forward operating base was located less than 24 miles from the Iranian border in a mixed Sunni-Shiite part of Diyala province. While the precursor to ISIS, then called the Islamic State in Iraq, was our principal foe, we were constantly worried about the presence of Shiite militias armed with a deadly Iranian-supplied weapon, the explosively formed penetrator, parenthetically EFP. For much of our deployment, the Shiite militias were quiet, except during a terrible series of weeks in the spring of 2008. They rose up, deployed their EFPs, and destroyed one of our Humvees, killing two men I knew. Soleimani's influence and power had only grown in the years since my deployment. He was an active enemy combatant commander working closely with other U.S. enemies. and when the Shiite militias, under his influence, parenthetically, and probable outright control, again in December, attacked Americans in Iran and besieged the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, it was clear that he was still a threat. So there was ample military call for striking Soleimani. There was also sufficient legal justification. It is a basic aspect of the law of armed conflict that opposing commanders are a legitimate target. Soleimani had entered a theater of armed conflict as a co-belligerent with Shiite militias. But to say that the strike was militarily and legally justifiable does not necessarily make it wise. Both the Trump administration and the Iranian regime are approaching the crisis from a position of relative strategic weakness. While the U.S. military is unquestionably the dominant military force in the world, it has currently deployed a fraction of the combat power to the Middle East that was present during the height of the Iraq War. And the American people have little appetite for a new war with an adversary far more deadly and capable than Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The Iranians face their own substantial challenges. The regime is in economic distress as a result of crippling U.S. sanctions. It has faced serious internal protests, and there are signs that Iraqis have grown weary of Iranian influence. Iran's limited missile strike on January 7th relieved Trump of the perceived imperative of immediate escalation. In the absence of U.S. casualties, now is the time for the administration to pause, guard against further retaliation, and signal clearly that it does not want war. At a time of great risk, the U.S. needs a steady hand at the helm. It needs a president who possesses strategic vision and exhibits tactical agility. Americans have no reason to believe that Trump is such a man, as he fills Twitter with bluster and reinforces U.S. troops. Yet another U.S. president has learned that a promise to end U.S. entanglement in the Middle East is far more easily made than kept. This article by David French. Going back to the original article, since the 444-day hostage crisis that ended Jimmy Carter's presidency, Iran has exulted in playing an outsized role in American domestic politics. Ronald Reagan's presidency was tainted by the Iran-Contra affair. George W. Bush's presidency was demoralized by Iranian machinations in Iraq, and negotiations over Iran's nuclear program consumed the latter part of Barack Obama's presidency. Trump ran on an election platform of reducing America's presence in the Middle East and avoiding, quote, stupid wars, unquote. But his erratic approach, provoking an escalation cycle while simultaneously making clear his aversion to conflict, only increased Tehran's appetite for risk. And so thousands of U.S. troops have arrived in the region, every one as a buffer against an emboldened Iran. And we come to another companion article, again under the general heading Viewpoint, and this headline is, Iran's history of war helps us understand its next move, by Elliot Ackerman. Time explains Ackerman's forthcoming novel is Red Dress in Black and White. He writes, in 1981, at the outset of the Iran-Iraq War, Qasem Soleimani witnessed his country's first use of human wave-style tactics. That costly practice would become one of the hallmarks of a conflict that would claim nearly a million lives on both sides and would see a return to World War I-style trench warfare and the widespread use of chemical weapons. A key result of the conflict was Iran's adoption of a national security strategy that relied on asymmetrical warfare, parenthetically, terrorism, wars by proxy. The Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, Quds spelled Q-U-D-S, the Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, led by Soleimani for more than 20 years, played a crucial role in the implementation of this strategy, which ensured that Iranian society would never again experience such a bloodletting. Now, Soleimani is dead. Nearly a decade at war left me with many dead friends, and when tallying up how they died, I can trace more of their deaths to Iranian-supported Shiite militiamen than to card-carrying members of al-Qaeda. His replacement, Ismail Ghani, and the entire high command are not only the architects of America's low-intensity forever war with Iran, but are also veterans of the Iran-Iraq War. Their experience will factor prominently into crafting a post-Soleimani strategy and whether that response will lead them into an escalatory spiral that could precipitate a more costly conventional war. Despite nationalist anger at the death of Soleimani, Iran's internal politics are as fractious as our own, and those divisions will soon re-emerge. Both of our nations have little appetite for a protracted conventional war, with anxious Google search terms such as the draft surging in the U.S. If there's a shared appetite for anything, it's de-escalation. Navigating that process will be challenging. It will require pragmatism and moderation on the part of Iranian leaders. However, our decades-long limited war with Iran has yet to spiral out of control. That the formative experience of Iran's generals was a futile, conventional war with few parallels in history cannot be emphasized enough. That experience may allow us all to avoid further escalation. But despite the best of intentions and the clearest of strategies, luck always plays a role on the path to war. The days ahead might very well prove as precarious as that calamitous summer of 1914. This entire companion article by Elliot Ackerman. We go now to another article, and this one is entitled, under the section of Nation, the headline is Pelosi's Play by Molly Ball. She begins her article, Nancy Pelosi isn't wild about the question. The impeachment of President Donald Trump is underway, and I've asked the Speaker of the House if she thinks it's the most important thing she'll ever do. We're sitting in her elegant office in the Capitol on gold-upholstered armchairs around a low table topped with a vase of hydrangeas. Over her shoulder, the sweeping view of the National Mall is shrouded in wintry clouds. For a long moment, the Speaker goes silent as she seems to compile in her mind the list of accomplishments she'd rather claim as her legacy. Quote, apart from declaring war, this is the most important thing that the Congress can do, unquote, she finally says. Quote, I'm most proud of the Affordable Care Act, but this is the most serious initiative that I've been involved in my career, unquote. Pelosi has spent decades at the highest levels of politics, but the past 12 months have been arguably her most consequential. Returning to the speakership after 8 years running the House Democratic minority, She established herself as counterweight and constrainer of this divisive president. She outmaneuvered Trump on policy, from the border wall he didn't get to the border agreement he signed, loaded with goodies that Democrats wanted. She oversaw an unprecedented litigation effort against the executive branch, racking up landmark court victories, and she was the tactician behind the investigation that resulted in Trump's impeachment on December 18th. What is most striking about this moment in Pelosi's career is that at the peak of power, she is not protecting her position, but rather using it in aggressive, even risky ways. Impeaching Trump is a gamble for Pelosi. It has intensified Republicans' fealty to the president, rallying his base, and supercharging his campaign fundraising, potentially increasing his reelection chances. The polarizing effort could jeopardize Democrats who hold seats in Trump territory and thereby endanger Pelosi's House majority. With impeachment, Pelosi is betting her own place in history. And we go now to another article in the section called World. The headline here is, Leader of a Lonely Island. Subheading says, Taiwan's Tsai Ing-wen seeks re-election in the last truly free place in the Chinese-speaking world. Article by Charlie Campbell, Dateline Taipei. He writes, In the early 1980s, a young Taiwanese student, newly enrolled at the London School of Economics, heard a knock at her dormitory door. A pair of bedraggled British students were there to ask Tsai Ing-wen if she wanted to subscribe to a newspaper. In the spirit of collegiality, she readily agreed. Quote, It was only later that I discovered it was a communist newspaper, unquote, she tells Time, laughing. Quote, I eventually told them to keep my check, but just stop sending the newspaper, unquote. More than 30 years later, Taiwan's political leader is still fending off unwelcome leftist overtures. Elected president of the self-governing island of 23 million in 2016, Tsai set out to steer it further from China's orbit. Taiwan has its own military, its own passport, and the world's 21st largest economy. But ever since 1949, when Mao Zedong forces ended a civil war by chasing the nationalists to the island 100 miles off the mainland, the Chinese Communist Party, parenthetically CCP, has considered it a renegade province that must be reunited with China by force if necessary. Through most of the Cold War, the capitalist enclave was shielded by the West. But in a world China now aims to lead after embracing market forces, Taiwan's position has grown only more vulnerable. So has size. The Chinese strongman Xi Jinping, in January 2019, declared unification across the Taiwan Strait the, quote, great trend of history, unquote, and his campaign to that end has gathered in intensity. Tsai's first term was marred by diplomatic isolation, tightening economic screws, and repeated threats of invasion. Taiwan finds less and less room to maneuver between forced reunification and resorting to force to remain independent. Tsai took a substantial risk in December 2016 when she phoned U.S. President-elect Donald Trump to congratulate him on his election victory. The call was the first between American and Taiwanese leaders since the U.S. recognized the CCP's dominion over China, including Taiwan, in 1979. In an interview with Time, Tsai called the conversation, quote, a, quote, very natural thing, unquote, but it was deemed an affront by Beijing, one compounded when Trump suggested the U.S. might revisit the question of Taiwan's status as a part of China. The mercurial U.S. president adds a new wobble of uncertainty to the tightrope Taiwan has been walking for 70 years. Historically, even after embracing Beijing, the U.S. has maintained a strong unofficial alliance with Taiwan. But as Trump has become entangled with China on matters from trade to cyber espionage, some in Taiwan worry that the famously transactional American leader might view their country as a pawn to be exchanged for something else, like a preferential trade deal. Quote, if Taiwan becomes a major issue between Trump and Xi, nobody knows what Trump might do, unquote, says Professor Shelley Rigger, an East Asia expert at Davidson College in North Carolina. As Taiwan approaches elections on January 11th, the question for its people is whether they will trust Tsai to safeguard their democratic way of life. Her main opponent, nationalist candidate and Kaesong mayor Han Kuo-yeo, hopes to convince voters that working closely with an increasingly influential and assertive Beijing will ultimately better protect the island's de facto sovereignty. Quote, Taiwan has one choice, to engage with China, because we can't hide, unquote, Han recently told students at Stanford University. But Tsai's Democratic Progressive Party does not endorse the idea that island and mainland are the same country. Formal independence for Taiwan is a key goal in its party charter. Beijing says any move to, quote, secede, unquote, would be met with a military response. And Tsai has pragmatically sidestepped the issue while in power. But her policy of prioritizing ties with other Asian nations has deeply troubled the Communist Party leadership, as has her full-throated support of pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Now the future of Taiwan, without rival the freest place in the Chinese-speaking world, as a U.S.-allied, liberal, democratic beacon in Asia is under, quote, constant assault, unquote, Tsai says, as Beijing tightens the noose on restive populations at its periphery, from Xinjiang to Tibet to, of course, Hong Kong. The CCP sees this election as an opportunity to do the same to Taiwan, Tsai says, something she is determined to prevent. Quote, Beijing would like to use a divided Taiwan to see our economy and development stall, to create a better foothold to influence cross-strait relations, unquote, she says. Quote, however, when it comes to Taiwan's sovereignty, democracy, and freedom, I believe our people are mostly in agreement, unquote. Tsai, 63, is a technocrat and former academic who has tried to shrug off a reputation for aloofness with a dizzying schedule of campaign events. On a single day, time followed her to a kindergarten, a farm, a technology conference, and half a dozen temples. On another, she inspected frogman drills at military camps before tea at an artist's retreat. She's hoping this kind of retail politics can reverse a decline in her popularity over her first term in office, driven by party divisions, unwelcome pension reforms, and embarrassing scandals like bodyguards caught using official trips abroad to smuggle cigarettes. Her decision to make Taiwan the first place in Asia to legalize marriage equality sparked a fierce conservative backlash. Still, Tsai, herself never wed, remains proud of the achievement, which, quote, shows that Taiwan is an open and inclusive society and a rather mature democracy, unquote. She is also suffering from the kind of resurgent populism afflicting democracies the world over. The viral rise of Tsai's nationalist opponent has been precipitous enough to be called the, quote, Han Wave, unquote. His chest-thumping speeches and outlandish promises during his successful mayoral campaign to drill for oil in the contested South China Sea and bring casinos and Formula One to Kaohsiung have naturally drawn comparisons to the 45th U.S. president. Quote, you cannot have a conversation about Han Kuo without Donald Trump coming up, unquote, says Rigger. Quote, everybody sees the parallels between these two guys, unquote. Tsai isn't blind to the risks. Quote, the rise of disinformation and populism have brought great challenges to leaders and governments around the world, unquote, she says. Yet the challenge is greater for Taiwan, with a rapacious Beijing lurking, and she believes, pulling the strings. In the months leading up to the vote, Taiwan has been hit by a tsunami of false reports masquerading as news stories in its partisan and sensationalist media, often targeting Tsai. Her administration and independent analysts say a large proportion originate in the CCP's United Front Propaganda Department, though the Chinese government denies any such campaign. So Tsai is fighting back in kind, charming voters with renewed zeal and posting social media videos of her frolicking with the two cats and three retired guide dogs she's adopted. The key to protecting Taiwan's democracy, she says, lies in, quote, public participation in our efforts to counter disinformation, unquote. It has worked, if her improved numbers are anything to go by. A widening lead might also be explained by the ongoing turmoil in Hong Kong, which for over 6 months has been convulsed by increasingly violent pro-democracy protests against encroachment by Beijing. Last January, Xi suggested Hong Kong's system of semi-autonomy, known as, quote, one country, two systems, unquote, might eventually be a model for Taiwan. But that idea had little support among Taiwan's citizens then, and even less now that unrest has engulfed the former British colony. Quote, the Hong Kong situation has, of course, negatively affected the Taiwanese people's trust in China, unquote, says Tsai. Still, Taiwan has been sucked into the escalating crisis. Its citizens have marched in support of Hong Kong's right to self-determination and offered safe harbor to fleeing protesters. In October, Taiwan expelled a mainland tourist for vandalizing a public memorial in support of the demonstrations. Tsai sees a dire warning for her people in the leeching of freedoms there. Quote, seeing these developments in Hong Kong, the Taiwanese people feel the need for a leader who can stand firm, insist on what has to be insisted upon, and clearly express their will, unquote, says Tsai. If Tsai is reelected this month, she will have to helm Taiwan through a period of deep uncertainty as Beijing's geopolitical clout continues to grow. Today, the island, officially known by the archaic pre-Civil War name Republic of China, is blocked by Beijing from joining the UN or potentially lucrative free trade groupings. It is now recognized by only 15 countries after seven switched to Beijing during Tsai's first term. Beijing is also squeezing the island economically. In August, it stopped the free movement of independent Chinese tourists to Taiwan, a free-spending cohort that comprised 82,000 arrivals per month in 2018. The burning question for Taiwan is how far Beijing is prepared to go. Quote, China is already taking steps similar to what Russia did in Crimea, unquote, says Taiwan's foreign minister, Joseph Wu, referring to the annexation of the Ukrainian peninsula. Moreover, he says, were China's slowing economy to foment domestic unrest, then Taiwan might find itself, quote, a very easy scapegoat, unquote. In order to mitigate the risk, Taiwan has sought to spread its influence indirectly, building cultural, economic, and humanitarian ties. During the recent presidential crisis in Venezuela, for example, Taiwan was one of the few actors able to send much-needed aid over the border from Colombia. To boost its soft power, Taiwan offers international cooperation in unconventional areas such as media literacy and disaster recovery. Quote, many of our allies still support Taiwan because they share the same values with us and will not be swayed by China's economic inducements, unquote, says Tsai. Yet because few small nations can ignore Beijing's dollar diplomacy, Taiwan's ties with the U.S. have taken on newfound importance. The U.S. has moved in recent years to offset China's attempts to isolate its wayward province, much to Beijing's ire. In March 2018, Trump signed the bipartisan Taiwan Travel Act, which boosts the exchange of high-level officials. Then, last October, a U.S. bill to protect Taiwan from Chinese diplomatic pressure won Senate approval. That same month, former Republican presidential primary candidate Ted Cruz became the first U.S. senator in 35 years to join Taiwan's National Day celebrations, cementing a, quote, friendship that has never been more important as Taiwan stands up to the Chinese Communist Party's oppression, unquote, he tells Time. One of Tsai's first priorities, if reelected, will be to build on these overtures from allies in Congress. She may need them, as China's ambitions are widely believed to stretch further still. In the South China Sea, it has militarized disputed islands and reefs into fortifications dubbed, quote, unsinkable aircraft carriers, unquote. In September, the Pacific nations of Kiribati and the Solomon Islands each restored diplomatic ties with China, a move Tsai's government believes may give Beijing an enhanced foothold in the region. Quote, China took them by strategic design, unquote, she says. Quote, if the international community does not react strongly, China might make changes to the Pacific in the same way as the South China Sea, unquote. Although Beijing insists these and other fortifications are defensive in nature, Tsai isn't buying it. Quote, China's military capacity is still growing, and it harbors expansionist intentions, unquote, she says. The danger is that the alarm bells might be ignored by a world so entwined with Beijing economically, including the U.S. But for Taiwan, there's no choice. The islanders will, as ever, be standing in the breach. And that is the article written by Charlie Campbell from Taipei. And we have just about run out of time for this edition of Time Magazine. You've been listening to North Carolina Reading Service, and I urge you to continue doing so, especially for our next edition of Time Magazine. This recording is intended for folks who are blind and print impaired. You've been listening to your loyal reader, Randall Rickman, who apologizes for the slips of the tongue during this reading. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. This is Randall Rickman providing that number one more time, 919-832-5138. We certainly enjoyed having you with us. Please join us next time for your time.